Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge. Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really big one, a concept that's probably, well, one of the most argued over and maybe misunderstood political ideas of the last 100 years. Fascism.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's face it, nowadays you hear fascist thrown around constantly. It's almost like, you know, the go-to insult for anyone you disagree with politically.
Exactly. It's lost its analytical edge, hasn't it?
It really has.
So our source for this deep dive is Kevin Passmore's Fascism, a very short introduction. And our goal is pretty straightforward. Get past the shouting, move beyond the buzzword, and actually give you, our listener, a more precise historical toolkit to understand this force.
And why does this matter now? Well, I think it's crucial because we really need to understand how these kinds of movements emerge, how they actually function, and maybe most importantly, why people find them appealing. Just condemning them isn't enough.
Right. Understanding takes a bit more work.
It requires rigor. Yeah.
And Passmore, he starts right off by saying, look, forget the idea that fascism is some kind of stable, easy to pin down ideology.
Exactly. The fact that it's hard to define, that's actually the key insight. It was always shifting, opportunistic, full of contradictions.
So that's the core idea we're exploring. We're not hunting for a simple definition you'd find on Wikipedia.
No, the question is more like, how should we actually think about and analyze movements that show these kinds of characteristics? How do we approach it?
Okay, so let's talk about our guide here, Kevin Passmore. He's a reader in history at Cardiff University. His focus is modern Europe, especially the French right.
And what makes his take so useful, I think, is that he's not just a historian looking at, say, Hitler or Mussolini, the sort of success stories, if you can call them that. He's what's called a historiographer of fascism.
A historiographer. Okay, what does that mean exactly?
It means he studies the study of fascism. He looks at how historians and thinkers have actually debated and reshaped the concept over decades. His focus is on the analysis itself, how our understanding has evolved.
Ah, okay, so he's studying the playbook for studying the playbook. That's interesting, but why look at the failures? Don't the big examples like Italy and Germany tell us what fascism is?
Well, yes and no. His expertise across different countries, especially looking at movements that didn't manage to take power, like in France or Britain, stops us from just creating a definition based only on the specific situations in Italy and Germany.
Right. It forces more nuance.
Exactly. It prevents oversimplifying. You learn a lot from why some movements failed, just as much as why others tragically succeeded.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's get into the book itself then. Passmore, you said, he challenges those simple checklists people sometimes use, like Umberto Eco's famous points.
Yeah, he sees those as helpful starting points, maybe, but ultimately not enough. They miss just how dynamic and paradoxical fascism really was.
And the paradox seems central here. You mentioned it was revolutionary, talking about a new man completely changing society.
But at the same time, deeply conservative. It had to make deals with the old guard, you know, the military, big industry, sometimes the church, just to get a foothold and then seize power.
It's kind of dizzying.
Yeah.
Embracing cutting-edge technology, radio, film, mass production for its goals.
While fundamentally rejecting the very basis of modernity, things like reason, individual rights, the idea of universal humanity, all out the window.
So how does Passmore help us make sense of this bundle of contradictions?
Well, he structures his analysis around sort of three main battlegrounds where scholars have fought over fascism's meaning. First, there's the Marxist perspective, focused mainly on class and economics.
Okay.
Second, the liberal view, which often emphasizes totalitarianism, the attack on democracy, state control, that sort of thing.
And the third?
The third, and maybe the one that gets closest to explaining its emotional pull, is the culturalist view. This looks at fascism through its myths, its symbols, its rituals, almost like a kind of political religion.
And Passmore suggests we need to consider all three.
Pretty much. You can't really grasp the whole thing without seeing how these different interpretations highlight different facets of it.
Right. So let's start with that definition problem. The classic Marxist idea that fascism is just, you know, a tool for big business to crush the workers. Why is that too simple?
Well, mainly because it doesn't really explain the genuine, widespread, popular enthusiasm it generated. It kind of reduces millions of people's motivations to just economics.
It ignores the passionate belief, the revolutionary feeling.
Exactly. And it overlooks the fact that many early fascist movements actually used quite strong anti-capitalist language themselves. It just doesn't capture the hearts and minds aspect.
Okay, so that leads us to Passmore's idea of the fascist minimum, the kind of core ideas most scholars can agree on.
Yeah, the absolute essential elements, and the most crucial one, the real engine driving it all, is this concept called palingenetic ultranationalism.
Palingenetic.
Okay.
Okay, that's a mouthful. Can you break that down for us?
Sure. Palingenesis basically just means rebirth or regeneration. So it's not just extreme nationalism, it's this core driving myth that the nation as it currently exists is sick, it's decadent, it's corrupt.
And it needs to be reborn.
Violently reborn, spiritually reborn, totally transformed from the ground up, purged of weakness to achieve its true great destiny. It's this incredibly powerful idea of national renewal through struggle.
That explains the extreme language, the constant talk of enemies within, and purification. It's not just policy disagreement.
Not at all. It's existential.
Yeah.
And flowing directly from that core myth are other key features, like the absolute belief in the leadership principle, the Führerprinzip in German. The leader isn't just a politician, they embody the national will, the destiny of the reborn nation.
And the focus on creating this new man.
Yes, this ideal citizen, heroic, disciplined, totally devoted, ready to sacrifice everything for the nation and the leader. Obedient, but also, paradoxically, dynamic and action-oriented.
This is where that culturalist interpretation really comes into play, right?
Yeah,
People like George Moss.
exactly. You can't understand why millions were drawn to this just by looking at voting patterns or economic policy. You have to look at it as filling a kind of spiritual void.
Like a substitute religion.
Precisely. Viewing fascism as a political religion helps explain how it offered people a sense of meaning, purpose, belonging, especially in times of rapid change and uncertainty. Think about the mass rallies, the uniforms, the symbols, the rituals, the stories of martyrs. It created a whole world, a sense of sacred mission.
And how does that contrast with the liberal model, the one focused on totalitarianism?
Well, the totalitarian model defines fascism mainly by how it ruled total state control, use of terror, propaganda, the cult of personality around the leader. Passmore says, yes, those are descriptive features of the regimes, but focusing only on those methods can actually hide crucial differences in ideology. For instance, if you just label both Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union under Stalin as totalitarian, you might miss the fundamentally different driving
So
forces.
that's the key difference there, according to this view.
For Nazism, the absolute non-negotiable core was racial purity, specifically a virulent biological anti-Semitism. Everything served that goal. For Soviet communism, at least theoretically, the driving force was class struggle and economics. Their goals, their targets, their ultimate visions, they were profoundly different, even if some methods overlapped.
Okay, that distinction is important. So if the core ideology is about violent rebirth in action, let's shift to fascism in practice. This wasn't just theory, it was all about doing.
Absolutely. It was an ideology of action and struggle. Violence wasn't seen as, an unfortunate tool. It was actively glorified. It was seen as necessary, even purifying the thing that would forge that new man and cleanse the nation.
And the paramilitary groups, the black shirts in Italy, the SA, the brown shirts in Germany.
They weren't just bodyguards. They were the embodiment of this principle. Street fighting, intimidating opponents, political violence that was the movement in action, demonstrating its vitality and ruthlessness.
So who was drawn to join these groups, to embrace this ideology? What was the social base?
Well, interestingly, it wasn't initially the super rich or the established elites. The real core constituency, especially early on, was the lower middle class. Think artisans, small shopkeepers, white collar workers, some farmers.
People feeling squeezed.
Exactly. Squeezed by big business and organized labor, feeling like modernity was leaving them behind. And crucially, you had huge numbers of deeply disillusioned and often traumatized veterans from World War I who felt the nation had betrayed their sacrifice.
And here's maybe one of the most chilling historical lessons, something you really need to grasp. Fascists rarely seized power in a classic revolution, storming the palace gates.
That's right. More often, they came to power semi-legally. They were invited in. There was often a disastrous pact with the devil, meaning the traditional conservative elites, the army leaders, the industrialists, the landowners, the monarchists, they were the ones who held the keys to power. and they often feared the political left, the socialists and communists, far more than they feared these radical nationalist movements.
So they made a deal.
They made a deal. They thought, okay, we can bring Hitler or Mussolini into the government, use their popular support to crush the left, maybe discipline the workers, and then we'll tame them, control them.
A fatal miscalculation.
Absolutely catastrophic. They underestimated the ruthlessness and the revolutionary drive of the fascists they thought they could manipulate.
Okay, so once they are in power, Pathmore points out, it wasn't always the perfectly efficient, monolithic machine we might imagine, the totalitarian goal versus the reality.
Right. Total control was the aspiration, but the reality, especially in Italy, was often messier. Mussolini, for instance, had to make compromises. He couldn't just eliminate the influence of the Catholic Church or abolish the monarchy overnight. He had to negotiate, coexist.
So the state wasn't always a single entity.
Often it was more like a chaotic network of competing power centers. The party, the state bureaucracy, the military, various leaders vying for influence under the dictator. Less a machine, more a tangled web.
How did the two main cases, Italy and Germany, differ once in power?
Well, Italian fascism under Mussolini is seen as the prototype. It was more pragmatic in some ways, defined partly by those compromises. Economically, its big idea was corporatism.
Corporatism?
Yeah, the idea was to organize the entire economy into state-controlled syndicates or corporations, bringing together workers and employers in each sector, supposedly to end class conflict. In reality, it mostly served to control labor and benefit big business allies while suppressing independent unions.
And Germany. Nazism under Hitler.
That was the far more radical and ultimately destructive version. As we mentioned, the non-negotiable core was racial purity, driven by that obsessive biological anti-Semitism.
So less compromise on the core goals.
Yeah, far less. That racial ideology dictated everything. Domestic policy, law, foreign policy, the drive for Lebensraum or living space in Eastern Europe, and ultimately the Holocaust. The extermination of Jews and other groups deemed inferior wasn't a byproduct. It was central to the entire Nazi project.
It shows the horrifying endpoint when that kind of racial ideology becomes the absolute center of state power.
It really does.
Okay, let's pull back a bit. If we boil down Passmore's analysis, what are the main themes, the big messages we should take away?
I think the first one is about the definitional dilemma itself. The very fact that it's so hard to define, that scholars argue about it, that's the point. Fascism wasn't a fixed doctrine.
It was a scavenger.
Exactly. It picked and chose ideas from the left, from the right, from nationalism, from tradition, from modernity. So you shouldn't expect a neat little box to put it in.
So the reflection for us is, when you look at movements today, don't just slap on the label. Ask. What's the core appeal? Is it mainly about class? Is it about attacking democratic norms? Or is it more about that cultural, spiritual, national rebirth idea?
Right. Locating the core appeal helps you analyze it more effectively. The second big theme is that contradictory modernity.
The anti-reason but pro-technology thing.
Yeah. Fascism rejected, Enlightenment values reason, individual liberty, equality. But it had no problem using the most modern tools, mass media, industrial power, advanced weaponry to achieve its goals.
The takeaway there is pretty stark, isn't it? Technology itself is neutral. It can be used for liberation or oppression.
Absolutely. And the third key theme, which we've touched on a lot, is that fatal alliance with conservatism.
The gatekeeper's failing.
Yes. Fascism was radical, even revolutionary in its aims, but it often got its chance because the established conservative powers were more scared of the left or saw an opportunity and let them in the door. They enabled it.
That feels like a timeless warning for anyone living in a democracy. Keep an eye on who the traditional power brokers are aligning themselves with.
Definitely. Watch the gatekeepers.
Okay, let's highlight a few core ideas from Passmore that really stick. Not exact quotes, maybe, but the essence of his points.
Sure. I think one key idea is the core mobilizing myth is palingenetic ultranationalism, a revolutionary project for a new national community. That really captures the emotional, spiritual driver behind it all.
Right. It wasn't just politics. It was a crusade. And another one.
How about this? Fascists were often invited in by conservative elites who feared the socialist left more, wrongly believing they could control the beast. That underlines the political calculation, the moral failure, that opened the door.
Yeah, the contingent nature of its rise. And maybe one more on that paradigm.
Fascism represented a form of alternative modernity, rejecting reason but embracing technology. That really highlights how movements can look both backward and forward at the same time.
So how do we take all this analysis and apply it? What are the real-life applications for us listening today?
Well, the first is pretty direct. Critical media literacy.
Meaning, use the tools, not just the label.
Exactly. Don't just call something or someone fascist because you disagree with them. Analyze it. Are the specific elements present? Is there that cult of the leader? Is violence being glorified? Is the core message about national rebirth through purification and struggle? Be precise.
Okay, what else?
Second, learn to recognize the signs of democratic erosion. Passmore's analysis highlights specific warning signs. Things like the normalization of political violence, making threats against opponents seem okay.
Or sustained attacks on institutions.
Yes, systematic attacks on the free press, on the independence of judges, on the legitimacy of elections themselves. These aren't just political squabbles. They can be signs of that semi-legal path towards authoritarianism.
And maybe something more personal.
Yeah, developing personal guardrails. Mm-hmm. Be really wary of any political movement or leader that offers complete, absolute certainty or identifies one simple group as the scapegoat for everything that's wrong.
And demands loyalty over thought.
Exactly. That demands emotional commitment and unquestioning loyalty above critical thinking and asking tough questions. Those kinds of appeals prey on uncertainty and fear.
So, reflecting on all this,
yeah.
What's your biggest takeaway from digging into Passmore's work?
For me, it's the understanding that while historical fascism, the specific movements in Italy and Germany, were products of a particular time and place, its core ingredients, things like extreme nationalism, the lure of the strong leader, the promise of belonging through exclusion, those are persistent dangers. And we need historical precision to analyze them when they reappear in new forms.
Yeah, precision over panic. What stuck with me most is just how quickly things can unravel. The path from a messy, struggling democracy to outright dictatorship can be frighteningly short.
And it often happens not through some dramatic coup, but through those seemingly legal maneuvers, those alliances of convenience where established players make terrible judgment calls.
Which leads us to our final thought for you, the listener, to mull over. Think about those gatekeepers, the ones who hold institutional power. When they choose to align with radical, anti-democratic forces, they almost always believe they're the ones in control, that they can ride the tiger.
History, as Passmore shows, tells a very different and much more dangerous story.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.